Heads up, this episode contains some salty language here and there.
Yep, because even the rich curse.
It's 8 a.m., and Diana is lying in a London hospital bed about to give birth. And she's surprisingly relaxed. She didn't even take any pain medication.
Okay, going the natural childbirth route.
Yeah, well, except for the ice cubes that Prince Charles feeds her to numb the pain. He's, like, really excited to be a dad again. And he really, really hopes it's a girl this time.
Well, I guess they're in for a surprise.
Not exactly. Diana already knows she's having a boy. She saw a royal weenie on the ultrasound.
What, does it have a crown?
Yeah. How hilarious would it be if penises had crowns in
London?
They
do.
When they're born, they place a little crown.
You're royal and you're not.
But she couldn't bring herself to tell Charles. She knew he'd be devastated. And after 9 hours of labor, he totally is. Charles takes one look at Harry and says, "Oh God, it's a boy. And he's even got red hair."
What's wrong with red hair?
Charles doesn't have any redheads in his family, but Diana has a bunch in hers.
So basically, he's saying, "Oh God, the kid looks like you."
Yep, just what every mother wants to hear, right? Then he leaves the hospital and goes home.
Where he writes Diana a sonnet apologizing for being such an asshole, right?
No, he makes plans to go play polo.
What an asshole.
Yeah, that's how Diana felt too. She later said that something inside her died when Harry was born. I believe her quote was, "Our marriage just went bang."
Ugh, that's awful.
Yeah, which is pretty much the beginning of the end. From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. In our last episode, Diana found out that being a princess wasn't all it's cracked up to be. And in this episode, Meghan will pretty much come to the same conclusion, thanks in large part to the British tabloids.
And this is our final episode in this series, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a real nail-biter. This is episode 4. Battle Royale.
Ooh.
After Harry is born, Diana starts noticing Charles has developed some interesting new habits. Like, he's eating dinner earlier and earlier, and when he's done, he retires to his room where he circles all the things he wants to watch in the TV guide. And then he leaves.
So he writes what he wants to watch in the TV guide and then he leaves where his TV is? Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's a ruse. What he's really doing is borrowing the cook's car and driving over to Camilla's.
Ah, the ex.
Not so ex anymore. Remember when Diana overheard Charles telling her he loved her?
Right, he was in the bathtub. Why do the Brits like baths so much?
I don't know, maybe they feel like they're floating in a giant thing of tea.
Gross.
But Diana still isn't ready to let Charles go. She decides to try and win him back. In December 1985, Charles and Diana go to a sketch show at the Royal Opera House in London. They're having a jolly old time, the way British people do, you know, looking straight ahead, maybe occasionally nodding. But then, in the third act, Diana's like, "Be right back, darling," and she slips out of the royal box. Then she goes downstairs, changes into a white satin outfit, and then, surprise! She bursts onto the stage and performs a suggestive dance routine to Billy Joel's Uptown Girl.
So we've both done sketch comedy before. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being in the middle of your set and somebody pops on stage in a white satin dress and starts dancing to Billy Joel?
No. They're like, "We only have so much time for this sketch. We're not even getting paid. Like, get off the stage,
like,
lady.
This is a courtroom scene. Get out of here. You don't belong here."
But Diana's always wanted to be a dancer, and she practiced this for weeks. And she was actually pretty amazing.
Okay, so then was the prince impressed?
You tell me. Afterward, he tells her she was undignified, too thin, and too showy. If you're a royal, you're not supposed to do sexy dances, or any dances, or anything sexy.
How does Diana take it?
She's crushed, of course, and she's over it. If he can't be bothered to show the littlest bit of interest in her, She decides she's not going to be bothered to be the littlest bit nice to him.
A recipe for a happy marriage.
They start to fight about everything, but the main fight is around how to bring up the kids. Normally, the royals have an army of nannies, but Diana wants to raise the boys herself. Charles is like, they're princes, and they have to learn about princely etiquette and rules, like he did. And Diana wants to give them a semi-ordinary life. She wants them to play with normal kids and eat fast food and, I don't know, puke on roller coasters.
Okay, I've done all of these things, and they're all very overrated. So who wins?
They end up with a nanny, but Diana does occasionally take them out to, like, birthday parties and play dates, so there's that. I think what was most frustrating for Diana is that she never felt heard with Charles. He's got this kind of eye-rolly way of speaking to her, like she's some kind of annoying dummy or something. Well, Charles is happy as a clam, doing pretty much whatever the hell he wants. To the outside world, he still looks like a royal prince who does princely things. But behind closed doors, he's spending as much time as he can at his country house, because it's right down the road from the house of Camilla, his mistress.
Honestly, being the prince's mistress sounds way more fun than being his wife.
Yeah, right? Meanwhile, Diana is in Kensington Palace in London, lonely and hurt. And she finally gets so fed up, she turns to an unlikely source for advice.
The Pope.
What? No. The Queen.
That is unexpected.
Yeah, she and the Queen have tea each afternoon and talk about regular stuff like the weather and raising kids. She also complains about Charles and, yes, asks her advice. Her fix for Diana's blue mood is to issue a statement to the press. You want to take a guess what it says?
The Queen is terribly sorry that my dear son Charles can't keep his weenie in his trousers.
No, but I do love that we're saying weenie so much this episode.
No.
It actually reads, the Queen could not be more pleased with her daughter-in-law.
That's the statement. Attention, I have an announcement to make. I'm pleased with one person.
Yeah.
Who issues a statement about people they're related to in the third person anyway?
Right, yeah, that always throws me. That and the use of we. We hereby declare our daughter-in-law to be the most adequate person of the day.
We do not welcome any further discussion on the matter. The princess is hereby therewith considered okay.
And we heretofore deny anyone who would assert otherwise.
I feel like Diana needs some friends.
Well, in the summer of 1986, she makes one at Buckingham Palace.
While visiting the Queen.
Probably. But picture this. Diana is standing at the bottom of a staircase in the palace, barefoot and casual in a summer skirt. And a man in a full military uniform comes around the corner. And as he passes Diana, he gives her a long look. She looks back at him shyly. That's how I always picture her, just very demure and shy. Then she says, like the outfit.
Ooh, who is this lucky bloke?
His name is Captain James Hewitt. He's actually part of the Household Cavalry, which is like the most impressive branch of the Queen's army.
Okay, that's kind of sexy.
Yeah, you think that's sexy? Get this. Later that summer, they meet again, this time at a cocktail party. They get to chatting, and eventually the talk comes around to horseback riding.
Like all royal British conversations do.
Right. But Diana is scared of horseback riding. She was thrown off of a horse as a kid. But as it turns out, Captain James is an expert, and he offers to give her some lessons.
Nothing like a strong captain to help you get back in the saddle.
You know it. After one lesson, Diana's fine, and pretty soon they're going on long rides together. Diana is crushing hard, and a few months later, she works up the nerve and corners James and gives him a kiss. After Diana kisses him, she supposedly says, I need you. You give me strength. I can't stand it when I'm away from you. I want to be with you. I've come to love you.
But then she's like, but I'm married and I'm a princess and this will never work.
Nah. She waits until Charles leaves to spend a few days at his country house. Then she invites the captain over to Kensington Palace for dinner. They eat chicken and mashed potatoes. And then James drinks a bottle of wine that belongs to Prince Charles. And I'm sure you can imagine what happens next.
He falls asleep?
No. They sleep together. It apparently goes very well. Pretty soon, the captain's a regular visitor at the palace when Charles is out of town. They tell everyone he has to stay over because he's giving the boys riding lessons.
Ooh, another ruse.
Yeah, they're not the only ones getting riding lessons, if you know what I mean.
I don't know what you mean. What?
Anyway. The more time Diana and James spend together, the more obvious it is what's going on between them. Even Charles figures it out. But guess what? He doesn't care. He's pretty much in love with Camilla at this point. And if Diana wants to be with someone else, whatever. But it's a different story when the queen and her husband, Philip, find out about it. Philip freaks out. He thinks it's going to blow up in everyone's faces if Diana and Charles keep running around having not-so-secret affairs. And then he tries to get the queen to do something about it. But the queen's not interested in that. She thinks Charles and Diana are above divorce. They're royals. They have to set the moral standard for the whole country. Splitting up is for commoners. So Charles and Camilla keep sneaking around in the country, and Diana and James keep sneaking around in the city. Diana's finally with someone who really wants to be with her. It gives her courage. And that's when she decides to do something bold. It's April 1987, Middlesex Hospital, a drab brick building in central London.
I thought all buildings in London were drab.
Actually, the purpose of this one is pretty amazing. It's home to the first AIDS ward in Britain, and Princess Diana is there to dedicate it. And of course, the press is there to watch.
Anticipation always surrounds what the Princess of Wales will wear for an engagement, but it's rarely been keener than yesterday. Just one question dominated the whole day. Would she or wouldn't she wear gloves?
This historic moment and they're wondering about her gloves?
Oh, it's worse. The tabloids have been running articles that you can get AIDS by touching someone who has it.
That's awful.
Yeah. But Diana is determined to ignore the press. She just wants to meet patients. So she starts walking around, but none of the patients are in their bed. It turns out they're hiding from the camera crews because they're worried about what the tabloids are going to say if their picture's in the paper.
That's heartbreaking.
It is. But finally, Diana meets a patient who's not hiding, and she reaches out to shake his hand. Without gloves. Which might sound like a small thing now, but at the time it was a really big deal. There was all this stigma about touching people with AIDS, and Diana just cut right through it.
Officially, the princess was simply opening Britain's first purpose-built AIDS ward, but perhaps more significantly, she demonstrated to staff and patients her confidence that AIDS can't be contracted by casual contact.
I never knew that. That's freaking amazing.
It really was, and it flips a switch for Diana. She decides if photographers and journalists are going to follow her everywhere she goes, why not lead them to places that actually need attention? So she starts planning other ways she can bring positive attention to the AIDS crisis.
That is so cool. How is this going over with the Queen?
Well, the royals aren't ones to stick their necks out and tackle social issues. They're supposed to be neutral. They just want to be in the background, like, don't mind us. So the Queen calls Diana in for a meeting and politely reams her out. She says, and this is a quote from Diana's bodyguard who is standing outside, "Why don't you get involved with something nicer, something more pleasant?" I think it's actually kind of a pivotal moment for Diana. She realizes the royal family isn't going to support her doing what she wants to do. Add to that, she's stuck in this loveless marriage.
But at least she has Captain James.
For a while. But 2 years after Diana's visit to the hospital, he gets posted to another country and the relationship fizzles.
Ugh, she's back in the royal straitjacket.
Except for one thing. She has a source of power now, the press. She knows they'll report on anything she does, and if she plays them right, they'll take her side. So when a tabloid journalist named Andrew Morton approaches Diana to write a book about her life, she says yes. She wants some ownership over her life. She's pretty much breaking the biggest royal taboo of all. She's going to not only talk to the press, she's going to share all her secrets.
Holy crap.
There's just one catch. She makes Morton promise that anything she tells him will be attributed to one of her friends, not her.
She doesn't want to be implicated when shit hits the fan.
Right. So she records herself telling him everything. She talks about her sham marriage, her struggle with bulimia, and how much it sucks to be royal. And then she sends it to Morton, who calls the book Diana. Her true story. So 1 year later, on June 7th, 1992, the Sunday Times publishes an excerpt from the book. In it, Diana's friends talk about how cold Charles can be and how Camilla's such a big player in his life, and about Diana's bulimia and depression. The country is shocked and appalled. People aren't sure what to believe, and they can't get enough.
Do any of the royals have any idea this was coming?
No. They find out along with everyone else. They quickly issue a statement saying Diana had nothing to do with the book. but privately they know she must have been Morton's source. No one else could have told them the things he ended up writing.
Also, she had no friends.
Right? She hung out with the queen.
Yeah, exactly. So the day after the story comes out, Charles meets Diana at Kensington Palace. And for the first time, they talk about everything that's gone wrong between them. The lying, the cheating, the fighting. In the end, Diana gets up her nerve and tells Charles she thinks they should separate. And he agrees.
So that's it. It's over.
It's not. See, when you're an immediate heir to the crown, you can't get a separation or divorce without consulting the queen. So they ask for an audience.
An audience? What is this, an episode of Maury?
Yeah. No, that's like a British term for speaking with the queen. So Diana pleads with the queen. She tells her that she's tried everything in her power to make Charles love her, to make the marriage work. Now she's run out of options.
And what does Charles say?
Nothing. He's too scared of what his mum will say. So she's kind of left hanging on her own.
He doesn't want to get grounded. What does Her Royal Highness say? What is her grand and royal decision?
Her answer is no. Although she says it more diplomatically. She tells the couple they should take 6 months off. If things are still broken after that, then they can discuss a more permanent separation.
They've already had years off at this point.
Yeah, but Diana and Charles actually do give it a try. Sort of. They maintain a wary status quo. They steer clear of the tabloids. They're polite.
Of course they are. They're British.
I think they were waiting out the 6 months, sort of like a prison sentence. Maybe they'll have an amicable split and everything will turn out in the end for everyone. Except that's not what happens.
Is this the point I should get out the whiskey?
You might want to. I don't know why you've waited this long. The tabloids have gotten their hands on a private phone call between Charles and Camilla. And it's juicy. But it's not going to stay private for very long. Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay. Well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh, yeah. The Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. And So mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started. In November 1992, a British tabloid called the Daily Mirror runs a story with the headline, Charles' Secret Bedtime Phone Call.
Camilla?
Camilla, of course.
Of course.
I don't have the audio, but I do have the transcripts. Want to read them together?
Won't that be awkward?
That depends. Have you ever had phone sex in an English accent?
No comment.
Okay. I'll be Camilla.
Ugh, fine. I'll be Charles.
I can't bear a Sunday night without you. I can't start the week without you.
What about me? The trouble is, I need to see you several times a week.
So do I. I need you all the week, all the time. Oh, darling. Oh, I just want you now.
Do you?
So
do I.
Desperately. Desperately, desperately.
Okay. I think I'm scarred now.
You're scarred. I had to pretend I was in love with Charles. played by you.
It was your idea.
I mean, it was fun.
It kind of was.
But you know who doesn't think it's fun? The Queen.
Ugh, classic buzzkill.
See, she kept hoping that Charles and Diana would find their way back to each other. But when the Daily Mirror releases some quotes from the tape, it's clear there's no way back now. And the Queen is embarrassed. In December 1992, the Queen tells Charles and Diana that their six-month trial separation is ending early. They're permitted to separate for real. Before I play you the separation announcement, let me just say what a huge deal this is. Basically, people are worried about the line of succession. If Diana leaves the royal family, will her kids still be the rightful heirs to the throne? What if the prince remarries and has a son?
These are a lot of complicated what-ifs.
Yeah, now you can see why the country is practically in a panic. And the person tasked with making the announcement is the prime minister.
Madam Speaker, I know there will be great sadness at this news. But I know also that as they continue with their royal duties and with bringing up their children, the prince and princess will have the full support, understanding, and affection of this house and of this country.
Ah, the poor kids.
It's pretty hard on them. I mean, Harry's only 8 years old at the time and William is 10. They're at boarding school when the announcement comes. William pulls Harry aside and makes him promise that whatever happens, they won't take sides.
That's really mature for a 10-year-old.
Yeah, it actually really is. William tells his brother it won't be easy. They'll have to move around and divide up their time between their mom at the palace and their dad at Highgrove.
I can't imagine it's easy for Charles and Diana either. I mean, splitting up your kids?
Plus, they just blew up a system that's been in place for hundreds of years.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal.
After the announcement, Charles and Diana sit down, and one of them says, "Why did this have to happen?"
Charles was never around. When he was never affectionate.
Mm-hmm.
Then he gaslit Diana about the whole affair thing.
Exactly. Which is why it was surprising when Diana says to him that it wasn't his affair that destroyed their marriage. It was the people around us. They didn't give us a chance. She means the royals and their attendants, and of course, the tabloids.
Of course.
What's interesting, though, is they don't get divorced. Not right away, anyway. A divorce would be way too much of a shock to the public. Plus, there's another small issue. The Queen would never allow it.
I can't even imagine having a mother-in-law with final say in whether you have to stay in a loveless marriage. So what happens?
Well, Diana and Charles are basically in this weird limbo. They live completely separate lives. Diana tours countries like Zimbabwe and Nepal, countries battling poverty and despair, hoping to get the attention of the press in places that very few royals have been to.
And what is Charles doing with his newfound freedom?
Oh, he's off skiing in Switzerland.
I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah, it goes on like this for a long time. Diana trying to save the world and Charles watching as the press fawns over her. So Charles is getting kind of jealous. Plus, he's still pissed about that Morton interview Diana did a few years back. He thinks Diana took a lot of shots at him in that. And now she's going all over the world getting praise. He has a side, too, and he wants people to hear it. So he decides he's going to do his own tell-all interview with a BBC reporter named Jonathan Dimbleby.
What you want to try and do is look for a stag which is older. No, you don't want to shoot a young stag. And, I mean, what you're really trying to do, to all intents and purposes, I suppose, is act like the wolves did in the old days.
So it's a tell-all interview? About hunting techniques?
Yeah. I think Mr. Dimbleby is easing him into it. After they dispense with hunting, they talk about Charles' relationship with William and Harry.
The prince looks forward to their teenage years.
Brilliant. As they get older, there are more things that perhaps they, being boys, they could do with their father. And, I mean, that's, you know, obviously more and more enjoyable.
He's not saying anything.
I actually think that's kind of the point. People see Diana as someone just like them. So Charles wants to show he's an everyday guy, too, who hunts and cares about his kids.
Okay, but when do they get to the good stuff about the separation and Camilla?
Near the end.
Did you try to be faithful and honorable to your wife when you took on the vow of marriage?
Yes, absolutely.
And you were?
Yes. Until it became irretrievably broken down.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about. So he basically confesses he cheated on Diana.
Yeah, in that roundabout, polite British sort of way. And when Dimbleby asks Charles about his affair with Camilla, he doesn't deny it, but he tries to water it down with the oldest line in the book.
Mrs. Buggerbills is a great friend of mine. She has been a friend for a very long time.
He also talks about how hard it is knowing how to deal with the press.
Welcome to Diana's world. What does she think of Charles's big interview?
Oh, she's irritated. She can't believe Charles would try to make it seem like his relationship with Camilla was just some sweet old friendship. So she gets busy hatching a plan for revenge.
That does not sound like Diana, but I like it.
It's November 20th, 1994, and the streets of London are empty. Everyone's at home or in a pub watching an interview program on BBC called Panorama. Tonight's guest is Princess Di. Diana is wearing a black blazer and a crisp white top, and she's very soft-spoken as she talks about what ended their marriage.
Well, there were three of us in this marriage, and the pressure of the media was another factor. So the two together were very difficult.
So she's saying Camilla and the tabloids destroyed the fairy tale.
Pretty much. And then the reporter asks about her relationship with Captain Hewitt, and her answer is completely honest.
Did your relationship go beyond a close friendship?
Yes, it did. Yes.
Were you unfaithful?
Yes, I was in love with him.
Damn. Good for her. It's not like Charles's squirrely friend speech, is it?
Night and day. Oh, and listen to what she says about being queen.
Do you think you'll ever be queen?
No, I don't. No.
Why do you think that?
I'd like to be a queen of people's hearts in people's hearts, but I don't see myself being queen of this country. I don't think many people would want me to be queen. Actually, when I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into, because they've decided that I'm a non-starter.
Why do you think they've decided that?
Because I do things differently. Because I don't go by a rule book. Because I lead from the heart, not the head.
Ugh, I love this, but I can't imagine this kind of scathing honesty went over well with the queen.
Oh, yeah. The queen sits down and writes two letters. One to Charles and one to Diana. She tells them it's time for them to get divorced. It takes months for them to work out the details. I mean, they've never had to do anything like this. Divide up the royal spoils and duties. They decide Diana can keep living at Kensington Palace, but she has to give up her title. She won't be Her Royal Highness anymore. Hey, it's a small price to pay for her independence.
That's what she wanted.
Well, that's what she wants now. Before, she wanted to be a princess, but turned out that sucked. So now she wants her freedom. She also gets a lump sum payment of $25 million, plus $600,000 a year to cover expenses.
I'm trying to imagine what kind of expenses you'd have that would cost $600,000 a year.
Right?
How much is pita and hummus at Sainsbury's?
Like $5 a piece.
Okay, so that covers like...
Maybe she has like a royal waving coach who's just like constantly on the ball. Like,
or she's got to change her name on all those things because she's not Your Royal Highness. That's got to be
that
expensive.
That is pricey. That can add up for sure.
It's got to go to the DMV. And satin white dresses for
you
sketch shows.
Love those satin white dresses.
Who wears a satin white dress unless you're going to bed?
Are they, like, in England, are they like the women in the 50s who just always dressed up everywhere? That's what the royals are like.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Should bring that back.
But Diana and Charles are officially divorced on August 28th, 1996. And Diana starts to imagine her future. She wants to leave England and start a new life somewhere else, like America. But the queen says no.
Yeah, but the queen doesn't have any control over Diana anymore.
But she does have control over her grandchildren. They're heirs to the throne. Diana's just their mother.
The firm.
So that's probably what it feels like to Diana, but she accepts it. She grew up in the shadow of the monarchy, and even if she doesn't agree with the queen, she still respects what she stands for. So she stays busy doing charitable work. And then she falls for a new man. His name is Dodi Fayed.
He was like a playboy, right?
Yeah. Before Diana, he dated actresses and models and hung out at the Playboy Club in London. He's also insanely rich, the son of an Egyptian billionaire. And he's about as far as you can get from the stuffy British aristocrats Diana's been stuck with all these years. I mean, one of his relatives is an arms dealer.
Well, I guess if you've spent a decade married to the most uptight man in the world, I can see how you'd fall for someone a little more wild.
Yeah. And he falls for her, too. They have a glorious summer of love, only marred by the press following them everywhere they go, intent on reporting Diana's new guy. The paparazzi catch Diana on Dodi's yacht, and pictures appear on the cover of tabloids with headlines like, Diana's secret holiday with hunk Dodi. Anyway, in August 1997, they go to Paris. He wants to show her the Ritz, which his dad owns. And, rumor is, he's going to give her a ring. At 10 p.m., they go out for a late dinner in one of the grand upstairs suites. Then, a little after midnight, they decide to go to Dodi's apartment for a nightcap.
Is that a euphemism?
Yes, finally. One of the security guards agrees to drive them over. Their bodyguards take them out the back door to escape the paparazzi. And then they slip into the back seat of a Mercedes and they take off. I'm going to cut to the chase because we all know what happens. The paparazzi chase after them and they try to get away, but the driver loses control of the car and slams into a cement column.
She died at 4 a.m. after going into cardiac arrest. That, according to doctors at the hospital in Paris, Diana, Princess of Wales, is dead.
When Prime Minister Tony Blair announces her death to the world, he calls Diana the people's princess.
She was a wonderful and a warm human being. How difficult things were for her from time to time, I'm sure we can only guess at. But the people everywhere, they liked her, they loved her, they regarded her as one of the people.
A few days later at her funeral, 2.5 billion people watch from home. And one of those people is a 16-year-old girl in Los Angeles named Meghan Markle.
Full circle.
Mm-hmm, you know it. Which brings us up to where we left the story of Harry and Meghan.
Their fabulous wedding.
With celebrities and a choir and a few $100,000 worth of flowers. It was the beginning of a new kind of fairy tale. A prince marrying a commoner, more common than anyone before. Well, except she was uncommonly pretty.
And smart.
And talented.
Marrying a handsome, thoughtful, redheaded prince.
They're pretty much the perfect couple.
So it would seem.
But as we know, nothing is ever what it seems with the royals.
When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals more easily and still have the occasional treat.
Exactly. And Chime's here to help you do that. With a Chime checking account, you can make financial progress with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit.
Yep. So if you set up direct deposit into your Chime account and use an activated debit card, Chime will spot you up to your limit when you exceed your balance.
Mm, and I love that Chime never charges fees or interest for using SpotMe. To date, Chime has spotted members over $20 billion.
My God. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/rich. That's chime.com/rich.
Chime feels like progress.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse the levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories. Promo code IFSTORIES10 to get your magnesium breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/IFSTORIES. Promo code IFSTORIES10.
6 months after Harry and Meghan say, I do, they make a surprise announcement to the press.
Meghan's pregnant.
So much for the surprise. Okay, I'm going to play the clip anyway.
We do have some good news to share with you this morning. Royal baby news. Duchess Meghan and Prince Harry have just announced that they are expecting their first child.
Who doesn't love a baby? Even the tabloids must be thrilled.
Not so much. Meghan cannot catch a break. When she starts to show, the tabloids write a bunch of snarky articles about how she can't stop touching her baby bump.
Okay, what's wrong with that? That's how we know a woman is pregnant, is she's always touching her belly.
I know, I'm actually curious about that. Why do they touch their stomach in pictures?
I truly don't know. It's like a universal rule that if there's a picture of a woman and she's got her hand on her belly,
yep,
there's a baby in there.
100%. So, like, why are they always just calling the moms out on it? You know what I would love to see? I'd love to see a headline that says something like, Prince Harry can't stop touching his junk after successfully impregnating his wife.
Gross.
The tabloids also resort to schoolyard bullying. They start calling Meghan names like Baby Bump Barbie and say she's just touching her stomach for photo ops. They also call her Duchess Difficult and Hurricane Meghan.
That's ridiculous. She's literally growing another human being. That's already insanely hard.
Exactly. And that's why they decide to get out of town. First, they start renovations on a cottage outside of London. And then they start to talk about things we all talk about when we're going to have a baby.
To circumcise or to not circumcise?
That is the question. But no. Things like how to raise them. And unlike Diana and Charles, who were completely divided in how to raise their kids, Meghan and Harry are on the same page. They want him, or her, to be brought up like a normal kid.
It's a him.
Arisha, if this were Twitter, I would mute you. Please, stop ruining all the surprises.
Sorry.
And also, even though their children are entitled to be lords and ladies, Meghan and Harry have a list of regular people things they want their kids to do, like ride the subway, clean the house, have a job.
So more like a mashup of the worst parts of everyday life.
Yeah. And not that Meghan is totally ready for the worst parts of everyday life herself. She's still got 3 more months to go and a baby shower coming up. So she's going to New York for a baby shower planned by Serena Williams. When Meghan gets back to England, the Sunday Mail publishes a personal letter from Meghan to her father that she wrote after her dad ruined her wedding with those staged photos of himself.
The ones he sold to the tabloids, allegedly, for $100,000?
Yes. And the letter from Meghan basically says that his actions broke her heart and she will never understand it. She never meant for anyone to see it but her dad. And then he turned it over to the press.
Ugh. So now the press are wading into her private life and her personal relationships.
That's exactly how Meghan sees it. And she is done with the press poking around in her life. She's done with them trying to make her look bad. So she does something no one in the royal family has done since Diana. She speaks up. And then she takes it a step further. She threatens to sue the paper. She claims it was a violation of her copyright since she wrote the letter. But more than the violation, her threat sends a clear message. Stop messing with me.
That's badass.
2 months later, on May 6th, the newest royal edition comes into the world. Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor.
That's a big name for a tiny baby.
It is. 2 days later, they proudly show him off to the world on CBS This Morning. A nice show with a smiley American reporter.
What's he like? Is he sleeping well? Good baby?
Yes. He has the sweetest temperament. He's really calm and...
He gets that from...
Archie's missing something, though.
His teeth?
No, that's normal. He's missing a royal title. And Harry and Meghan decide not to give him one. He could have been the Earl of Dumbarton. Instead, he's just going to be a normal little boy.
I'll take the Earl of Dumbarton if it's still up for grabs.
I don't think they're ready for a female Earl. He'd be way too powerful. But their decision not to give Archie a title raises a few eyebrows. But Meghan and Harry's next move raises, I don't know, what's like the next thing after eyebrows?
Penis?
Seriously?
I don't think there is a next thing.
Okay, well, in July, they buck royal tradition in an even bigger way. They have a private christening, and they refuse to tell the press anything about it.
I bet the tabloids loved that.
Oh, yeah. They use it as an opportunity to remind the couple that baby Archie is funded by taxpayers.
Yikes.
But Harry and Meghan hold fast. They're committed to raising Archie how they want. They're not going to let some crabby pants in the press tell them what to do. They're busy changing diapers and planning a royal tour to Africa. Remember, like, 1,000 episodes ago, we talked about that ITV documentary, An African Journey?
Yes, one of the best documentaries I never saw.
Yep, that's the one, where the reporter got a candid interview with Meghan, and she admits in this sad voice that being a royal isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Perhaps you could just give us an idea of what the last year's been like.
It's hard. I had no idea, which probably sounds difficult to understand here.
It's like she hits rock bottom.
But she's about to claw her way back in a major way. At the end of the tour, she takes legal action against the tabloid that published her private letter. She sues them. And the press goes ballistic. Palace staff back in London are in shock, too. The royals are supposed to play it cool, pretend they're too high up to notice. I mean, it's like British tradition. But Meghan's not British.
But Harry is. I'm having flashbacks to how Charles wasn't exactly the biggest advocate of his wife. How does Harry react?
He issues a forceful statement in Meghan's defense. It's 3 pages long.
Are you going to read the whole thing?
No, I'm just going to read the best parts. There comes a point when the only thing to do is to stand up to this behavior, because it destroys people and destroys lives. Put simply, it is bullying, which scares and silences people. We all know this isn't acceptable at any level. We won't and can't believe in a world where there is no accountability for this.
I feel like we need to cue applause here or something. Can I just say there is nothing sexier than a man standing by his woman, prince or not?
I agree. When Harry and Meghan get back from the tour, he puts his word into action. They announce they're taking a 6-week sabbatical from royal duties. They go to Vancouver Island and hole up in this $14 million mansion.
Sounds like a fancy hole.
Yeah, they really had to slum it. In Vancouver, they hash out a plan. They basically want to be part-time royals. They want to spend half their time in England representing the Queen and the rest of their time living in Canada doing whatever they want. They write this up and send it to Charles and ask him what he thinks. He tells them they haven't worked out enough of the details.
Like what?
Like, how are they going to live? They've been getting a yearly stipend from the taxpayers. Are they willing to give that up? And there's another big question. Will they give up their titles? But like I said, Charles isn't on board. So Harry just goes around him and straight to the Queen. The Queen is firm. She doesn't want to get involved. She tells Harry he needs to figure this out with his dad. But she does make one request. Or it's more like an order because she is the Queen after all. She says, under no circumstances should he issue a public statement to the press before the whole family agrees on a plan.
And if Harry's anything like Charles, he'll listen.
Well, Harry's not like Charles. He's more like his mother. He respects his grandmother, the Queen, but he's not afraid of her. So a few days later, Meghan and Harry send an official statement to the family. It says, we intend to step back as senior members of the royal family and work to become financially independent while continuing to fully support Her Majesty the Queen.
That doesn't sound so bad.
Really? Remember, no one has ever walked away from the firm, except for the Queen's uncle, Edward VIII, who was pretty much exiled for falling in love with a divorced commoner.
Okay, so I imagine the Queen then puts her foot down and says, not on my watch.
She doesn't get the chance. 10 minutes later, they send the same announcement to the rest of the world via Instagram, along with a photo of them walking through the garden with giant smiles on their faces.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, oh, shit is right. No advanced warning, nothing. The royal family flips out. According to a tabloid called The Sun, Charles is incandescent with rage.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. I guess that he's so angry, he's glowing like a light bulb. And of course, the press go nuts.
The royal family is tonight facing the biggest rupture to the firm in decades.
The way this has been handled and the fact that a statement was put out apparently without either the Queen or other senior members of the royal family knowing about it is simply almost beyond belief.
Behind the scenes, everyone is scrambling. The Queen's weathered a lot of scandals in her time. But a grandson leaving the family? There's no preparing for that. Because it's never happened. So she does what any grandmother would do.
Knits him a sweater?
No. She invites the family to Sandringham to talk things out.
Ah, how new age.
Monday, January 13th, 11 a.m. Harry's Range Rover pulls up at Sandringham. He's alone. Inside, he greets his grandmother and his dad, and the three of them sit down to have some lunch. After lunch, Harry's brother, Prince William, arrives, and the four of them go into the long library, followed by their four private secretaries.
Is that four for each of them?
Yeah, they each have four.
So 16 secretaries.
I mean, it wouldn't be crazy. Harry's actually been there before. It's where he and his mom used to have tea at Christmas time. We don't know exactly what he said, but the meeting lasted for an hour and a half. And after everyone leaves, the Queen sits down and issues a statement. Although we would have preferred them to remain full-time working members of the royal family, we respect and understand their wish to live a more independent life.
Wow. That must have been tough. It's big of her.
I don't think she had a choice, but she's thought it all the way through. If they aren't going to work as royals, they can't have the titles. They'll no longer be royal highnesses. They'll no longer go on royal tours. And they'll have no more taxpayer money to fund their lifestyle.
But at least they'll be free.
And living in Canada. That's where they're planning to move.
You know what my takeaway from all of this is? Being royal sucks. We all think it's like the most glamorous thing in the world, but it's like a straitjacket.
Mm-hmm.
You can't move without the tabloids wanting to cut you in two. It's like the only thing you can safely do is move your hand back and forth in one of those wooden waves.
If you want to be a royal, you have to sacrifice everything, which is what's so amazing about Meghan and Harry. They weren't willing to sacrifice their own happiness to be a royal.
And so interesting how it all started with Diana, who was a commoner and an inspiration to Meghan and Harry's mother.
Mm-hmm. In March, Harry and Meghan made their last public appearance as official members of the royal family. And Meghan wore this emerald green dress and a matching hat. She looked incredible.
Right, but she'd look incredible wearing an emerald green leprechaun's outfit.
Okay, I don't know what that means. What I wanted to point out was that it looks almost identical to a dress and a hat that Diana wore at one of her early public engagements. In my mind, it's like a little nod to Diana, a way to say thank you.
And she gets the prince, so it's a fairy tale ending after all.
Yeah, even if they are going to have to give up their private jet for an Uber.
Can you imagine if you were an Uber driver and you picked up Harry and Meghan?
No, I couldn't. I would probably faint in the middle of the 405 or something.
I would totally get out wherever she stops. Like, if they were, like, going to, like, Ralph's, I'd get out. I'd be like, oh, I might as well do my grocery shopping, too.
You're like, this is how Ubers work in the U.S. Trust me.
It's an American thing. You guys wouldn't understand. This is the final episode of our four-part series, Diana to Meghan, From Commoner to Royalty. On our next episode, we'll be speaking to Frank Langfitt and Michaela Friel, two royal experts who will walk us through the latest developments in Megxit and what it means for the future of the firm. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening now. If you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast where you'll find a link on the episode notes and some offers from our sponsors. By supporting them, you help us offer you this show for free.
If you like what you're hearing, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. We'd love to know your thoughts.
We use many sources when researching our stories, like Vanity Fair, Town and Country, and yes, a few tabloids. But we especially recommend a few books. The Queen and Di by Ingrid Seward, The Diana Chronicles by Tina Brown, and Andrew Morton's biography, Meghan, a Hollywood Princess.
I'm your host, Brooke Siffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. Kayla Bissinger wrote this episode. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Sound design by Marcelino Villalpando. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marsha Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I'm I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect.